What I'm going to talk about is the work we did with Alexey Kornishev over the last 2 years. And it's related to understanding how various biological helices interact with each other and how they recognize each other, how they self-assemble under certain conditions, and what's responsible for it. And just to start off a little slow, I'll give you a sample of all kinds of biological helices you can encounter in nature. And there are quite a few of them, and of course everybody knows about DNA and protein alpha helices, and these things self-assemble. They're actually multimolecular helices, like tobacco mosaic virus. There are whole tissues which consist from helices. Like, for example, your tendons or your transparent cover of an eye is a tissue made from helices whose only function is to interact with each other and provide stability of the tissue. And those helices are collagen helices. And we are trying to study all kinds of phenomena related to interaction between helices. But for the purpose of today's talk, I'll focus primarily on interaction between DNA helices. And there were really nice introductions to DNA made 2 days ago, and it's kind of been a theme of that meeting to a large extent. So let me put here, just to remind you, a picture of DNA, and I'll be returning to this picture throughout the talk. And let me show you one of the systems of really huge importance for us, where DNA helices interact with each other, and that's a structure of a nucleosome which was solved a few years ago. A little over a year ago. And it has a protein core, which is histone, and it has DNA wrapped around it like thread on a spool. And you can see the strands of DNA interacting with each other, running roughly parallel, so the two. It makes a full turn and comes back and interacts with itself. And what I want you to take home from this picture is that configuration is fairly typical for DNA-DNA interaction in biological systems and in many other cases, where the two DNA helices are separated roughly by 10 angstroms of water, 8 angstroms of water or so. Well, in that case, it's not pure water, of course. There's also protein in between and chains coming out from protein. But there are also structures from DNA which you can make in a laboratory experiment which will have that separation. Actually, there was a lot of discussion about DNA condensation 2 days ago. And when DNA condenses with those poly ions or with multivalent ions, it does not condense into a dry aggregate. The helices are separated by about 8 angstroms of water, and I'll come back to that. And there are lots of puzzles, and there are many interactions, as I've shown here, and there are lots of puzzles related to interactions between DNA helices. But before we go into that, let's come back to the picture of DNA and get some handle on distances and scales, because this is really important. So here it's just a picture which I copied from this book. And for me, it was a very useful exercise to read this book. And I don't know if you're not aware of this book and you're interested in nucleic acids, I highly recommend it. But this is A form of DNA and this is B form of DNA. And most common form of DNA, which we find and most biologically significant, is a B form of DNA. And I put some characteristic distance scales. So the red things on DNA are phosphates with their oxygens. I painted all of this stuff red. And these are negative charges, they're sitting here. A characteristic distance along a strand, so this is a strand of phosphate connected by sugars. Characteristic distance between these phosphates on a strand is 7 angstroms. There are two grooves separating two strands in a double helical DNA. In the B form, there's this minor groove, which is more narrow, and there's a major groove, which is a little wider. And you can see this characteristic width of the groove in axial direction, not in a normal direction to the phosphate, but in axial direction, and it's fairly large. And I'll come back to significance of that. You can look at A-DNA, and there's the first puzzle right here. Experimental puzzle, which existed for a long time. The phosphates are much closer together in A-DNA. The width of this narrow groove, which actually used to be this major groove physically. So the same residues which are sitting here at the bottom of a major groove, they're here in the narrow groove. So what you do when you go from this form to this form, you collapse this one and you expand this one. And what happens? Phosphates get much closer together. And why would DNA want to do that? There's a big increase in electrostatic repulsion between them. And you know when this happens? Primarily when you condense DNA into an aggregate and start compressing, start taking water out. Why would it want to condense phosphates so much? That's one of the puzzles. There are quite a few other puzzles which exist from the early 50s or 60s. And there's a particular paper I like, which I'll just put for the title, and if you want to quote the reference, that's 1960, and it's a classical paper by Morris Wilkins and his collaborators. And in that paper, well, one of the reasons I like it, they provide this table, which is rather interesting. All kinds of forms of DNA measured by that time by X-ray crystallography, and those are all crystals. And as you can see, well, it's the same DNA. They're all monovalent counterions. There's nothing fancy here, no cobalt, no anything of that sort. And depending on the counterion humidity, there are all kinds of forms of DNA. There's A-DNA, there's B-DNA, there's a variant on B-DNA, there's C-DNA. Well, actually, you can get D-DNA with these kinds of things. They pack into all kinds of different lattices. They pack in hexagonal lattice. They pack in arteriombic lattice. They pack in monoclinic lattice. And inside those lattices, there's something circled by green here. What these two numbers mean, it's how are they shifted relative to each other, what you can measure by crystallography in axial direction. When it's 0, 0 for A-DNA, they're not shifted at all. You can get one molecule from another by translation. Here, for example, they're shifted by 1/4 of a pitch. Here, they're shifted by 1/3 of a pitch. Well, if you add up numbers. Where is this coming from? It's totally unclear. Why would DNA have such huge variety of different structures in terms of the structure of the molecule itself and the structure of aggregates. Totally unclear. Now let's...
One column you didn't highlight there, which is my purpose, the relative humidity.
Yeah, it depends on humidity, sure. Yeah. Yes, but it doesn't depend that much on the tension. Humidity is a big factor, and I'll come back to that. Absolutely, yes. And I'll come back to that transparency. Let's move a little bit in time. And some years later, there was another puzzle uncovered, which remained a big puzzle. People have learned how to measure number of base pairs per helical turn in solution. So if we come back to this picture just for a second, it was known for a long time how to do it in a crystal. Here's the number of base pairs per turn. 11, 10, it's an integer number here. Well, they learned how to do it in solution, and what they uncovered, that what appears to be B form of DNA, well, let me get it higher a little bit, has 10.6 base pairs per turn in solution, and it has 10 base pairs per turn in fibers. And there were even thought that maybe they're different forms of DNA, and it was not understood for a long time. And you can imagine what's causing it if there's steric interaction between DNA molecules. But in these two papers, they found out you solve A-DNA. Over here, there's about 10 angstroms of water between DNA molecules. It's still 10-0 number of residues per turn. And in this paper, they also say that when they had about 10 angstroms of water, they still had 10-0. So they're saying there must be some interaction. If you read this transparency, I'll put it here, and you can read this abstract. There must be some interaction responsible for it. They just don't say what interaction and how it does it. And we'll come back to that. So there's a whole bunch of puzzles. And there's one puzzle which was discussed extensively 2 days ago. But I would reformulate it slightly differently. And I would make it a paradox. And I will not... Well, it was a very nice lecture by Victor Blomfield, and he already mentioned that there are certain things which just don't fit into simple theories. That it seems to be that DNA structure or structure of molecules which binds to DNA may be important. Well, let me throw in a little more. For one thing, and what I consider a main paradox, let's start with simple ions, as simple as possible. Cobalt, hexamine, and other things are not that simple. Let's compare calcium and manganese. Calcium precipitates anything that contains phosphate. Calcium phosphate is a rock. You take a lipid layer with phosphates on top with charged phosphates, falls out. Micromolar calcium, out. You take single-stranded DNA, it precipitates it. But you take double-stranded DNA, and consider single-stranded DNA has more configurational freedom. It should be more difficult to precipitate. You take double-stranded DNA, it doesn't precipitate it. Now look at manganese. It doesn't have such high affinity to phosphate. In fact, experiments show that a lot of manganese goes not onto phosphates on DNA. And yet, manganese condenses DNA, precipitates it. Victor mentioned that it denatures it, and it sure does at pH 4, at which the experiments were done, Victor referred to, but at pH 7.5, or larger than 7, it doesn't denature DNA, and yet it precipitates it. Forms nice structures. Divalent ion. Why is that? What's causing it? Well, there are all kinds of other puzzles. And sometimes we believe that it's only 3-plus ions which condense DNA. Well, here's the diamines, which condense DNA. And this is diamine with an organic linker, CH2. And if this number N, how many times it's repeated, is 3 or 5, it condenses DNA. But if it's 2, 4, or 6, it doesn't. It's another puzzle. And there's something interesting here. There's some empirical hint on what may be going on. And I'll come back to that. And I won't read this on transparency. I'll come back to that. I'll put it here. And you can read it. And I'll come back to that a little later. So there are lots of indications, in fact, and in particular from all those kinds of things, that when two DNA molecules interact, the structure of DNA may be very important. If we just make the most simple picture, just play with cartoons, right? Take B-DNA, 1-B-DNA, take a second B-DNA, and try playing with them. Depending on how they're aligned, you would suspect the interaction would be different. As I said before, and let me replace transparency over here, and I'll come back to this one. Look at another thing. Typically, as I mentioned, this distance when two DNA molecules interact is about 7, 10 angstroms. Look at distances here. 7, 14, 20. When you see something like that, you immediately suspect that charge discreteness effects in electrostatics must be important. So you start thinking, maybe there's something there. Maybe traditional models of DNA when helices are charged rods or strings of charges, maybe they just can't capture certain effects. Of course they can capture some effects, but maybe you throw the baby out with the water with respect to certain other effects. And to answer this question, what we have to do is we have to build a theory of interaction between two helices or inside an aggregate of helices which fully accounts for the structure. We know where the phosphates are. Let's try to get it in and see what happens. So the idea of building this theory would be try to minimize assumptions with respect to the structure. But you still have to simplify. In any theory, you have to simplify. What we'll be simplifying a little bit is equations for the field. piezoelectric field, right? Will work within linear theory. And I don't want to dwell on that much. And also, we're interested not only in interaction between two DNA helices, we're also interested in interaction between, let's say, DNA helix and a protein helix, two protein helices. So let's take a look at the following problem. Here's a top view. We have two helices for DNA that would be the same size. There is an internal core in the helix from which water is excluded and has a different dielectric constant. And this internal core would provide image forces, and it's very important to keep image forces in, as we'll see later. There are charges which represent these phosphates and which represent also condensed counterions or bound counterions or what have you, which might be countercharges. Here, for simplicity, they're drawn on a single cylindrical surface surrounding the core. They don't have to be there. They can be three-dimensional. And for the field equation, for the potential, we write simple linear theory. And if this distance is large enough, maybe we can use Debye lengths here, although corrected for certain effects. If we come to that, I'll explain that. If these two helices are very close to each other, what happens is that you have to treat all ions explicitly, and then it's a pure Poisson equation, and they simply know this term. But then you have to treat all counterions explicitly, every floating counterion explicitly, and it's doable. And if you want to build a theory of this system, there are certain levels how would you want to do that.
Certainly, yeah. Gary Manning with the best plotter rather than the baby with the best plotter. Right? Aren't you concerned about that?
No, I'm not throwing anything.
With linear isotopes, you throw away.
No. I'll explain why not. But let me go to that. Well, two words. What you have here, you have phosphates, right? And you treat condensed counterions explicitly. All condensed counterions will be present in the theory explicitly. Okay? It's only the diffuse layer which will be present here.
So that's the Bjerrum picture.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. That's the Bjerrum picture. So that's the approach. And it's doable. Now, how you do this? How you do this? How to solve this problem correctly? First, you have to find electrostatic energy for any distribution of these counterions and phosphates. And condensed counterions can move. Phosphates can't. But condensed counterions can move. So you do a couple of things. First, you find the Hamiltonian of this system. Then, when you fix coordinates of every condensed counterions, for example. And for fixed coordinates of every condensed counterion, which is treated explicitly, you find electrostatic energy. Then you would have to calculate a partition function in which condensed counterions can move. Right?
How about number of counterions? How many do you put on each?
Well, you'll find it self-consistently. When you've solved... Oh, yeah, yeah. When you solve the full problem, you'll find everything self-consistently.
One is neutral, another one has one minus. So one.
Yeah, I mean, this is... I was trying to represent something fairly random. So the first step of solving this problem, and I'm not saying that we went all the way. Of course not, because the problem is complicated. But we're moving along the way, and I'll try to leave you with the picture where we are today. The first step is to solve electrostatic problem when all condensed counterions are defined with given coordinates. And it turns out that this electrostatic problem for this particular geometry has an exact analytical solution. And, I almost forgot something. And then if you want to solve an aggregate, you have to build an aggregate. And there will be some non-additive interactions when you build an aggregate, like a hexagonal aggregate, but let me not dwell on it. Otherwise, I won't be able to go through. Since being at NIH and not yet at the University of Minnesota, I have to talk to biochemists a lot and listen to biochemists a lot, right? When they give a talk, there's always a huge gel with lots and lots of lines, right? And everybody kind of knows that everybody understands the line, and I feel myself a complete idiot because I can't make anything out of that gel. So just for presenting talks, I present exact solutions and say, oh, that's completely trivial. You know, you put this there, and you know, it goes. But in fact, this is the exact solution of this problem, and it's fairly complicated, but it is an exact analytical solution. And it's nice to have an exact analytical solution because what you can do with an exact analytical solution, then later you can make certain approximations and make it simple so that you can at least see it, but you can play with your computer and see how good those approximations are.
Can you just tell us exactly what did you find? You started with the linearized photon Boltzmann.
I'll tell you.
Okay, so you will get.
Sure. So, and... And yeah, 10 angstroms, let's say. Yes. Well, let's get back to that because this is an extremely important point. Diffuse layer. Right.
Outside those charges that are stuck on, so it's an artificial distinction, if you like. But it's a pretty realistic one, especially at low enough
temperature. It's more or less the same picture as a Bjerm picture for electrolytes. But let's not get onto that. Now, when these helices are really condensed, we consider another case where the helices are really condensed, when there's very little water in there, when they're practically touching each other. In that case, water is under dielectric saturation. You have to treat... There's no Debye atmosphere. You have to treat every single ion, every single fractional water charge explicitly, and then do the whole thing. And the solution looks slightly different, but we still can get it. It is, because in that case, there are no image forces. And that's why it's shorter. Because in that case, every single partial charge in water is treated explicitly. And electronic polarizability is roughly the same in the core and in water. Not quite. Let me go through to the results, okay? Which is much more interesting. So you can do all of this theory, and you can finally simplify equations. And there's a little bit of importance to equations here. Because what you find eventually, and I'll come back to this slide, is that electrostatic energy, this is energy, this is not free energy, I want to stress that. That electrostatic energy is actually just a quadratic form. And it's a quadratic form which consists from a structure factor, which defines where all the charges are. There's a definition for structure factor, which in here, given for simplicity, for the case when all charges lie on a single cylindrical surface. It's just simply more cumbersome equation when they don't, but not that much different than you can write it. And interaction propagator. So what happens? Your structure is sitting here, and this is just geometry of the problem. Actually, both cases, both limiting cases, when the distance between DNA helices is large enough and where it's small enough, they look the same, except for propagators look slightly different. And I'll come back to that. But what's important is that the structure factor here influences energy enormously. And once we get to that structure factor, and before we try to, we know where the phosphates are. That part of the structure factor we can get. We don't know where the condensed counterions are. We have to solve that. But before we would solve this problem, what we would do is just to play with the Hamiltonian a little bit, just to understand its physics, just to feel it a little bit. And in that case, what you do, you use some kind of empirical arguments on roughly what you expect the structure of a condensed layer to be. And you consider some simplest cases, for example, completely smeared condensed layer. Or condensed layer with counterions primarily on phosphates like gerrymanning showed in the picture from Jerram and Beveridge. Or something else. And for those model cases, we can calculate the structure factor, substitute them into equations, and get some results. And what do you get? Now, this is still Hamiltonian. This is not free energy, so I must warn you. So when you calculate this electrostatic Hamiltonian, you can play at the beginning without self-consistency. You can simply play with this theta parameter, which is the amount of condensation. And for this simple pictures, this is actually, for simplicity here, it's not even DNA, it's a single-stranded helix, just for simplicity here. And counterion, which is described by this theta, for simplicity, is smeared. What do you get? Well, if the theta is zero, you get normal DLVO repulsion. But notice, for a single helix already, when theta is slightly larger than 0.3, you start getting something here. You start getting an attraction. And then it turns back and goes into repulsion. They are long compared to their distance in the pitch, much longer than the pitch. So let's say persistence length is enough.
But if they're not infinite, then how do you confine the counterions to stay close?
Well, let's get back to that later, okay? Let me get through the results. Because there's no such problem in this formulation. So what happens? Where is it? Let's try to understand where is this, what is the physics of that attraction? It's actually very simple, because what we've done here, we're just testing the Hamiltonian, right? What we've done here, we smeared counter charge. We simply smeared it. And therefore, there's a counter charge density in a major group, right? And if helices can come together in this configuration, where phosphate is facing the groove, this phosphate will be closer to positive counter charge than to this phosphate. That's what gives you attraction. It's an axial charge separation which gives you attraction, but it's not axial charge separation which arises from fluctuations of charges. It arises from the structure of DNA.
There are two interwoven helices, one positive and one negative.
Well, in this case, the positive charge is smeared for this, for the previous picture, just for simplicity. In reality, it's not, of course, and you have to calculate where it should be.
Do you allow the condensed ions to go to the structure factor at the other raw combined?
In full theory, yes, but we are working on that right now, because that's the next level, that's the next step we have to take. Yes, it has to be done. But you can find something out already, even without it, just from the Hamiltonian. Just from that Hamiltonian, if you take the part which is phosphate-phosphate interaction and look, for example, how would DNA helices like to align with each other, you immediately find that at large separations in B form, they like to be parallel, and you get closer, you have something like a second-order transition, and they want to move. That's something unexpected, and that's for double helix. Now, let's get back to some of the puzzles I mentioned. Let's get back to this puzzle. Puzzle of number of charges per turn, per helical turn. How can we approach that? Since we don't know and we don't treat counterions correctly yet and we don't know where they are, let's take a look at phosphate-phosphate interactions only. It'll be just a guiding point, right? It's not a theory, it's just a guiding point. And if we look at phosphate-phosphate interactions, and if we calculate them within this theory, what we find out that the energy of electrostatic interaction strongly depends on number of charges per turn. It has discontinuities at every integer number of charges per turn. Very simple physics. Extremely simple. Look at DNA from the top. If you have integer number of charges per helical turn, let's start from this charge. You go full turn, the next charge will be right under this one. What does that mean? That all charges align into 10 axial ridges with 10 grooves between them. And if that happens, you allow such alignment of two helices as shown here, where phosphate looks into groove instead of looking into another phosphate. And you can gain electrostatic energy from this. It's extremely simple physics. Okay? And from that very simple physics, it turns out, you gain quite a bit of energy. So, for example, here, this is the gain in energy when you overwind from 10.6 charges, 10.5 in that picture, charges per turn to 10.0, And it's normalized by the elastic cost of that deformation. Now, this is estimate. As I said, this is only phosphate-phosphate. If you include counter ions, they'll actually make this energy bigger, and I could make an argument why. But you can see as you come close enough, and I wouldn't, you know, take any particular distance as a solid number. Of course, it's not, as I said, it's an estimate. But if they come close enough, when you cross minus one, overwinding becomes energetically favorable. And here's the picture of energy as a function of number of charges per turn. There's a very deep discontinuity at 10. So much for this. Let's go to the next step. Let's go to this B2A transition in a dense aggregate. Is this half an hour? Thanks. Again, we can estimate an interaction Hamiltonian. I'm still speaking about Hamiltonians. For B2A transition, and how we do it, we plug in a structure like it is, and we kind of make a reaction coordinate. The most important change here, actually, phosphates remain at about the same distance from the center. So in terms of electrostatics, the most important change here is change in the width of grooves. So we just use that relative width of grooves as a reaction coordinate. And we define it to be 0 in B-form DNA and 1 in A-form DNA, and it's just linearly changing in between with the width of grooves. And then we plot the following picture. Now, what this is an energy per phosphate in, per base pair in KT units, right? As you go along reaction coordinate. And second coordinate is this axial shift between molecules. Okay? So what happens, if you look at BDNA, it corresponds to 0, so it's this profile. And the most favorable alignment in BDNA, which we find from here, is a shift of about quarter pitch, quarter helical pitch. As you go to ADNA, because of the energy of interaction, ask me later why, there's simple physics for that, I just don't want to go into this, you actually gain favorable electrostatic energy instead of losing it. You lose on this, but you gain on interaction between two helices. You lose on making a groove narrow, you gain on interaction.
Are you using the same model that you had before with the smeared
condenser? Right now, basically, yes. Basically, yes. Because we want to, here again, we're looking only at phosphate-phosphate interaction. What happens if you smear counter ions? They're eliminated from the picture, basically. As if they don't exist. They just provide electroneutrality, that's all. So you should view this as what happens with phosphate-phosphate interaction.
You want to say that you don't need
electroneutrality? No, you need electroneutrality, that's why. No, I smear them. But let's go back into that. You smear them. And if you smear them, you eliminate them from this because none of the energies would be dependent on this. There are a few important points here. One is the magnitude of the numbers. These are KTs per base pair. That's a huge number on that molecular scale. This is not KT per persistence length. And persistence length is 150 base pairs. So you're talking like 1,000 KTs per persistence length. Another important point, in ADNA, the favorable alignment is zero. In BDNA, a favorable alignment, axial alignment, is not zero. And it's related to its structure, and I simply don't have time to play with pictures, but let me return. And this is pairwise. This is pair potential. When you go to aggregate, it becomes a little more complex. Let me come back to this transparency again. In ADNA, the most favorable alignment is zero. In BDNA, there's a particular form, arterhombic form, where really only nearest pairwise neighbor interactions matter, where the three-body terms are small because of geometry. And the most favorable alignment is quarter of a helical pitch. I'm not saying that this is a theory of this phenomenon. This is just a hint. To get a full theory, we need not only a Hamiltonian, we need a full partition function. And there are only two of us working on this problem, so it's just, you know, you can't get everything at once. There's an effect of counter ions, which Again, we cannot calculate rigorously yet, but we can try to model it. Let's do the following. Instead of smearing counter ions, let's put a certain fraction of counter ions in a minor groove and a certain fraction in a major groove, just for fun. See what happens. And if you do that, what happens if counter ions, in that case, actually, it's a fraction in a narrow groove, fraction in a wide groove. And what happens, counter ions, which like to sit in a narrow groove and close it on itself, like, for example, like lithium does, it prefers to absorb into narrow minor groove of BDNA. That's what people believe, at least. But BDNA becomes more stable. In terms of that, just electrostatic interaction Hamiltonian. And if we come back to that picture, you get B to A transition. Oops, sorry. You get B to A transition with sodium, potassium, rubidium, but not with lithium. It never goes into ADNA. It stays in BDNA and then it goes into cDNA.
So this is bridging between phosphate along DNA.
It does this, but also it's favorable for interaction between two helices. So the potential I'm showing here is not the bridging. I'm deliberately trying to separate it. So it's a mixture of several effects, and that's why I'm trying to stress.
So what you're showing us here is preference within a single?
No, two. No. This is for interaction between two DNA molecules. Preference within single is excluded deliberately. We don't want to treat it here. This is interaction between two.
How much smaller is it? What's the ratio?
Oh, they're comparable. They're comparable, but we're trying to dissect the system. And I don't have time to talk about everything. Of course they're comparable. Let's get back to this DNA condensation paradox. Not only you can observe condensation of DNA, you can do measurements of DNA-DNA interaction in a condensate. And those measurements were done by, for example, Rao and Persigian. And just look at three curves here, this yellow, green, and blue. Those are all DNA condensates with manganese, cobalt, and protamine. And protamine is a peptide protein, whatever you call, which is used by nature to condense DNA. And so what you see, as I mentioned before, that this is surface-to-surface separation in a DNA aggregate. And it's from 8 to 10 angstroms. That's quite a bit of water. When you measure interactions when DNA is not condensed yet, you can pull out experimentally what the debye length is. It turns out that you can perfectly describe forces, for example, for sodium DNA or whatever, with some effective debye length. And I won't stop at what effective debye length means, but it would be always around 3-4 angstroms. So you know that, and then you look at this repulsive force, what's preventing them from a contact? For one thing, this decay length is not 3-4 angstroms. It's 1.5, even less, and you don't understand it. So that's another feature to the paradox. And when I was showing you this picture, which I probably won't find, no, I found it. This picture for DNA-DNA interaction, there was this turn upwards. That's an image force, which prevents complete contact. Now, we believe that this is an image force. When we calculate it, we can calculate and compare it with the experiment numerically. And it turns out we get the decay length completely right. And to show that, I'll show a picture, not DNA condensate, but just for fun. Let's get into a slightly different system. Here's a guanosine monophosphate four-stranded helices, and the forces between them were measured by Italian group in that paper. And at a large separation, normal DLV works just fine. At small separations, you run into some interaction over here. And its decay length is 0.7 angstroms. And you start asking yourself, what is it? Is it the Bohr radius? Why is the length so small? What drives it? And well, it turns out from that calculation, we can calculate a force like that. We can calculate a decay length for image force. And there's a formula on the bottom here, which you probably can't see anyway. But it consists from Debye length, helical pitch, number of strands, and pi. And this is large number, 4 pi squared, number of strands multiplied, 600. And what turns out that this decay length is determined by pitch. Pitch is 40 angstrom. But because of this large number, when you do all the calculation, you calculate 0.7 angstrom, just exactly like measured. You can do the same trick with attractive forces, and I explained a little bit the nature of attractive forces. But for attractive forces, it would be an estimate. Because when for repulsive force, for image repulsive force, it's pretty accurate. You're not very sensitive to where the counter ions are. For attractive force, you are very sensitive with the counter ions are. But for simple model, I mean, what the hell? And it was measured, at least estimated. There was this condensation of the same guanosine monophosphate helices actually induced by a monovalent salt. Not divalent, not trivalent, monovalent, just high enough concentration. It has nothing to do with salting out effect. They eliminated that experimentally. They estimated the decay length of that force if you make assumptions that it's exponential. And you can calculate it from a similar relationship. There's just no 2 here, and there's a problem with Debye length here. We don't know it at very high salt concentrations, but the answer is virtually independent of it. For example, if you plug in Debye length for 4.5 molar KCl, you get 1.1 angstrom. If you plug virtually infinite Debye length, you get 1.4. So no big deal. What they measure is 1.3. Is the time up? No, it's a couple minutes. And you can compare those measured forces, et cetera, et cetera, and predictions for them based just on the Hamiltonian, again, not the free energy. And it looks encouraging. So it looks like if we calculate free energy, we can do even better. And just to conclude things quickly, rapid, let me go back to this transparency, this DNA condensation paradox. So I'll come up with yet another model for DNA condensation. And I'll base it on an empirical observation that all multivalent ions and polyions which condense DNA, about which something is known where they prefer to be on DNA surface, they all go into major groove. Cobalt hexamine prefers to be in a major groove. Manganese prefers to be in a major groove. And I forgot, there was a crystal structure for either spermine or spermidine DNA, and I forgot for which one. And in that structure, it was in a major groove. Protamines is a crystal structure for protamine DNA complex, and it's again in a major groove. And polylysine, there's an evidence that it's in a major groove. So let's make an assumption. What happens if we place our condensed counterions or adsorbed counterions, because actually these things, they chemisorb to DNA surface. That's not electrostatic condensation. Cobalt hexamine forms at least 4 hydrogen bonds with oxygens and probably more with bases. Manganese goes into major group because it prefers interaction with N7 on guanine base pairs. And in fact, its efficiency to condense DNA depends on GC base pair content in DNA. It tells you immediately that it's related to manganese being present in a major group. So let's make up a model, phenomenological model. Let's compare counterions which condense onto phosphate with counterions which condense into major groove. And let's compare calculated forces. And for phosphates, it's virtually zilch. It's about KT per persistence length. Major groove, it's quite a bit. Why? Because there's a larger axial charge separation if you go into major groove. If you go into phosphates, you virtually neutralize them. And it can go all and on and on. And all this was kind of a still Hamiltonian and stuff. But there's actually some generality in symmetry here. And whenever there's symmetry, there's a hope that even simplistic model describes something more general. And let's take a look. Let's go back to this equation. And dependence on structure is sitting in the structure factor. And let's remember something about phosphates on DNA. There's a certain symmetry of phosphate distribution on DNA. You can go upwards by 3.4 angstroms and rotate by about 30 degrees, right? And you go from one phosphate to another phosphate. So phosphate charge distribution is invariant with respect to this symmetry transformation. From this, you can immediately tell which indices in this expression will give zero values and which will give non-zero values, right? And this is fairly general. This will be preserved in free energy as well because it's just symmetry. From this symmetry, you can derive different rules for different indices for different charge distributions. And in fact, all of the results I told you about, you could derive just from these rules. You didn't have to go through all the fancy theories. You could derive just from these symmetry rules. It's just the symmetry of charge distribution, which appears to give rise to all those effects. Now, is the symmetry real? This symmetry is the same symmetry which gives rise to X-ray scattering. If there wouldn't be this symmetry, you wouldn't see these pictures. Oops. These dots are scattering on phosphates, right? And if there is a symmetry, then you see a spot. There's no symmetry, you don't see a spot. So you immediately know, I see these pictures, there is a symmetry, it's real. Regardless of base pair composition, the symmetry is still real. Why would we need the theory? Why would we need all those calculations? Could derive everything from a symmetry. And that's a concluding transparency, and I'll allude to the stop line shown by Michael Fisher that 1 over 64 pi is actually a very small number. Well, the number which figures in our calculations very often is these two numbers. These are big numbers. And just from symmetry, you don't get them. You have to calculate it. Where are we? Well, we calculated the Hamiltonian. We're working on partition functions for different problems right now. But again, there are only two of us, and we've been on this for about 2 years now. And there's just so much we can do. We'll keep working on it. And please ask questions. Yeah.
Very interesting model of the coming therapeutic, which brought 10.6 to 10, right? Why to 10, not to 11?
Oh. Well, this model can't answer this question because 11 would be just about as favorable as 10. So I guess this is something intrinsic to DNA. So there's some mechanical preference of DNA into which direction to wind. No. There's only one case in which you can predict a priori. It will be wild speculation, but extremely interesting. This is guanosine monophosphate helices. In that case, phosphates are not linked by sugars. So those base pairs can rotate freely. So from symmetry arguments, they form hexagonal aggregates. We can derive from symmetry arguments that the most favorable number of base pairs per turn should be divisible by 3, because a hexagonal aggregate is actually a triangular lattice. And it should be divisible by 4 because those helices have 4 equally spaced strands. Well, the smallest number you can find out of those is 12. Well, that's what they have.
This is seen that was a little bit 10.5. Yeah. In that case, that straight line that will be not that dense, yeah? Because you meet the other guy only after the
second period.
Yeah, and the basic line was for an irrational number. So if you have some form factor, some shape, or the bipolar factor, 10.5, this will be similar to the level.
Sure, so, but the level seems to be more than the 10.6, that's why I asked about the level.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Going from to the integer, I understood you were saying it's worthwhile to pay for the elastic energy of
specimens. Yes.
Another option is locally to bring the charges into air, so that by winding one
double... that is the winding.
One span over another, or the stretching of...
No. You retain the distance between base pairs, and you mostly wind. You turn base pair... Well, that's what gives it. You can't do each strand independently because the two phosphates which belong to two strands are fixed onto a base.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, one double strand.
Sure.
Okay. There's another possibility that one double strand of DNA will wind around the other.
One double strand of DNA will wind
around.
Yeah, it's we can't answer that theoretically yet. There is yes. We can't answer it yet, but we sure. No, Robin. There might be a point in what he is saying, but to solve this problem, what we have to do, we have to get an answer for two tilted DNA, and it appears that we're getting it, but it's too early to say yet. We're working on it, and it's very important to answer this problem in particular. Sure, but you can, and I would make a bold statement, which may be unsupported by results we have yet, because we haven't finalized them yet, but you can calculate electrostatic energy of a superhelical aggregate twisted like this.
And the elastic energy is much
smaller. I wouldn't say so for sure.
No?
I would rather calculate first. Yeah.
Apparently, in the Browning dynamics simulations, Niels Jensen on uniform error, you find that the spontaneous form staggered arrangements,
sure,
even very dissimilar from yours.
Sure.
There, the key conclusion was to get at fractions, you need to have highly correlated localized structures of the counter ion.
Sure.
Now, your rules will help the localization.
Absolutely.
So, I wanted to ask you, if you look at the difference between a uniformly smeared counter ion, your case one,
yeah,
second case, where you
localized
them. Yeah. I would guess from our experience that you could see a significant increase in the.
Absolutely correct. We've done that, yes.
So there could well be a weakened crystal of counter ions.
I wouldn't argue against that. There's an interesting feature, though. If you localize counter ions in a minor groove, you weaken the attraction. But if you localize them into a major groove, you strengthen it significantly. Compare it with this, yeah, and compare it with this.
When you smear the overall positive charge,
yeah,
you still have a group which is, you have a helix which is mostly
phosphate.
Negative phosphate.
Phosphate, yeah, right. No, and it's nearing counter charge only. Yes, yeah. Victor, please. Yeah.
I showed a picture of a DNA in alcohol.
Yeah.
There's the eighth one where the fibers were not.
Sure.
Like
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there some reason why interaction with A form?
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I didn't have time to talk about it. Yes, there is a reason. Basically, what happens here, the distance between these two phosphate strands is much smaller than here. So your phosphate charge separated better on A-form DNA. You kind of effectively, it's not a perfectly correct model, but as if you're merging the two strands and getting it a double charge. Those things form these types of attractions much more effectively. In fact, when we try to calculate for A-DNA, it should stick no matter what. And that's one of the speculations maybe why double helical RNA, you can't almost find it in nature, it's so sticky. It simply can't go into B form because its sugars can't go into proper conformation. But it's a wild speculation still.
Okay, I just wanted to have one very short point because Mr. Gage has shown you a revenge against the gel electrical resistance. Yeah? Show you this complicated picture. I want to show you one picture. For instance, how you reduce the result. And in those cases, for instance, of the smeared case, of smeared counterion, they have only three terms here. One is of the classical cylinder series of four uncompensated charges. That is your self-energy, the second term. And the last one is a cross term. And just if you look at the cross term, you will see an interesting thing. Here is the angle of the orientation of these two denier molecules. And since we know that rotation will be equivalent to the
taking it up or down, like delta Z shift, this is delta phi shift. So you can see that there is a part, this cross energy curve for double stranded DNA, which depends on the angle of the mutual orientation. And in a very funny way, you see the first term will be, if you attribute like a vector to this orientation, it will be a ferromagnetic coupling in quotation marks. And that one will tend to sustain this DNA to look at 90 degrees angle. So in the end, you get a compromise, and they like certain angle of separation, which depend on the distance r. But they didn't show that. So the distance, actually, to show that this angle appears when you draw this molecule to the distance of 36 angstrom of the DNA number. And then it starts to rotate and have preferential orientation. Now you see that is the position in which this molecule would like to love each other. And the other in the community may not be happy about it at all. So you will have a lot of frustration then in the assembly. And it's a very interesting statistical mechanical problem. And some people who are doing that, they have no interest in DNA, but have interest in magnetism, are attracted by this result because it's a very peculiar object in this case to see what will be the thrust rate. And Sergei has shown only again one quotation to the case of this Morris-Wilkins group result when you have different types of structures, not hexagonal structures. But there could be also more complicated structures that simply are the wrong structure. That was my short comment on that, and that means that making a theory, even with very huge results, when you reduce it cloudily to something, it helps a lot as well.
Could you give a reference
to that picture? No,
I'll
give you later. Yeah. Right. Okay?
Okay.
Actually, it was here structured like not public.
Doesn't it mean that this is a region requiring a very specific angle as a function of distance between the cylinders in the bundle makes this kind of attraction extremely vulnerable to any temperature motion and like rewinding and rewinding forward and stuff. So this is sensitive to the parallel alignment.
Well, it doesn't make it extremely sensitive. So what happens is that you can, well, first of all, there's no full answer to this question until we calculate the partition function. But we have a hint. Because what we can do, we can construct an aggregate by our hands where we give those alignments just by hands, right? And make a hexagonal aggregate. And for that aggregate, calculate the traction. And it's still 20, 30 kts per persistence length. No. There's no one single long DNA. There's a persistence length as an independently interacting unit. I would argue that in all interacting systems, there's always a persistence length as a single interacting unit. And that's very important to keep in mind. And what happened in Toroid, you just condensed all of those persistence, you know, all of those pieces into a particular form which is held together. They kind of, you could as well just break the link between them. They would still be in the same structure.
Okay, I think Yulia asked a very important question. But the point is that in many cases, the answer is no to your question. Because if you compare, for instance, the energy gain for various counter-ion distributions which Sergei has collected and shared today, in that case, you would get huge energy when the particles are close to each other. And when I showed, for instance, this picture, this magnetic analogy, it's not to look for criticality and not to look for critical exponents, because these energies, when you project, this was written like in two dimensions, which you project when you're summing all these directions across, along the helical model. And in this case, you get such a large pre-exponential factor there. So in the end, you basically have to deal with not frozen stuff, but with the ground state. The fluctuations will have a minor role unless you expand yourself. And when you go to some, maybe 36 angstrom between them, and then there will be an interplay between the temperature. And probably that is one of the reasons of polystatic transitions which are there, but we cannot conclude it from the parallel rock theory that will come from the twisted theory. But I think in many cases, we have to start with the ground state estimate.
At least as a starting point. No, I'm not.
I think he's quite right, actually. A slight misalignment is something unrealistic. You should have something which is robust, slight change still should give you significant attraction, right?
Sure, you're absolutely right. The changes, in fact, one of the things we've done, we estimate, is because it's very interesting, there are torsional fluctuations of DNA, right? which reduce the symmetry, et cetera, et cetera. And you can estimate and calculate, because you know torsional elasticity, how would they affect things. Also, you know that phosphates are not perfect, and you can calculate how they affect things. And those small deviations, they don't matter that much. Yeah, well, Ed, let me answer you privately, but one of the basis of the answer is that independently interacting unit is always a persistence link.
If Julia was speaking about the rival effect, that was really counted, and that killed high order harmonics there, and you can see the problem.
No, but just, well, anyway.
Let me start the second here, except for this last question, then we hold it.
That's very nice. Are you pursuing
not at the moment.
Okay,
there's just such a huge variety of all kinds of phenomena which is open to us that we simply, we have to choose.
Thank you very much.